Okay, good afternoon, good morning, everyone. Dennis Darby here again. Thank you for joining us, our CME and CMC members, for the COVID-19 briefing call. This is our fifth edition, and at last count, we had just over 600 member companies signed up for today's call. We're going to continue these half-hour calls, Tuesdays and Thursdays, now at 1:10 p.m. Eastern Time, as long as we need to. So there's been a lot happening in the last couple of days. I want to report some developments. First of all, you will have read, provinces have begun to shut down all non-essential businesses, but by and large, manufacturing is being exempted. This is work that your CME team has been doing in the background, diligently across the country, making sure that our supply chain and our members are able to stay as an essential service, and also to try to give the reassurance to their employees that manufacturing is an important part of keeping our economy going. Ontario is the model so far. They've exempted all of manufacturing and supply chains and transportation. As of this moment, Quebec is a bit more restrictive, but we're working to help them to expand the list. And, of course, we're talking to the federal governments. They certainly have power to set a national exemption, but apparently they're not going to invoke the Emergencies Act just yet. But we'll make a case for the supply chains to make sure that that we are included and that you are able to continue to do the work you're doing to keep the economy going, to help encourage employees to come to work. Everything is really related, and it's really not manufacturers work across provinces. So we're really hoping that we can get this work going in a positive way that keeps us all be able to contribute, especially to work to the COVID-19 efforts that many companies already have. Let's talk about the last few days in terms of what's happened. We've issued a whole list of policy asks to the government to help in manufacturing. We've got some movement on many of them. We've obviously, depending on where you are, we've got some deferrals on a collection of payroll and other taxes, and the deferrals are halting of fines and audits. In some parts of the country, and again, it really is a bit of a checkerboard of different rules, but things like hydro rates getting cut in Ontario, at least we believe that's going to be the case, some relief on property taxes. There's been some funding that we asked for to scale up manufacturers to help defeat COVID-19. At a policy level, there's been some simplification on EI and work sharing, but I know that Judith is going to talk an awful lot more about that later. And of course, obviously, we're trying to make sure that we get subsidies for manufacturers. And we also, there was some clarification last week, the temporary foreign workers, anyone who has a valid visa will be entitled to work in Canada. So I know there was a lot of concern about temporary foreign workers in some sectors of the manufacturing ecosystem. There's lots more that needs to be done in terms of additional measures to help workers, to help manufacturers keep their workers at work. And we really need to find a way to ensure, as we've said over and over, no manufacturer should fail because of the COVID-19 crisis, and there's a huge role of government who've been setting the rules to also actually help, and we think those measures are coming. I want to commend our members and all manufacturers on the goodwill you're showing to respond to government calls for help. We've received dozens and dozens of emails, actually hundreds of emails and calls on how you can help out. We've created a web form that can be found on CME's COVID-19 webpage for you to fill out. Don't forget our ongoing call to any manufacturers that make N95 masks, surgical gowns, gloves, face masks, and face shields, and medical devices. Please, we're in direct contact with the government on this. Please, if you have information, if you're a supplier, if you're offering up your facility, if you've got testing capability, anything that could be related to helping us, and if you're an existing supplier to one of the principal manufacturers and you have capacity, but please continue with that. On our last call, by the way, we received a lot of email questions after we wrapped up. So we've put all those answers. Thank you, Matt, and our guests from the last call. We've put those answers on the COVID-19 webpage of CME. So that's enough. I tried to do as fast as I could. That's the stuff that's done. Now, today, we have two speakers who will talk about the EI system, about records of employment, employment law, and strategies for managing our workforces in these trying times. So today, we have two external to CME guests. We have Judith Andrew, Commissioner for Employers of the Canadian Employment Insurance Commission, and we have Laura Gibbons, Senior Consultant, Human Resources Consultant with BDO Canada. Now, Judith and Laura will speak for 5 minutes each, and then we will have Q&A. But we've changed it up a bit today. That's right, just in response to requests from our members. Rhonda Barnett, President and COO of Abbott Manufacturing and our immediate past chair of our board of directors, is on the line today, and she will moderate a Q&A with Judith and Laura and ask questions on your behalf. But if you want to ask your own question, if Rhonda doesn't cover it, we want you to send your questions, and we will have those asked as well. So just to remind one more time, the man with the most well-known email in manufacturing in Canada, Matt Poirier. It's matt.poirier@cme-mec.ca. That's matt.poirier@cme-mec.ca. He'll take your questions and communicate those to Judith, Laura, and Rhonda. So with all the preliminaries out of the way, let's start over to you, Judith, and welcome.
Thank you, Dennis. Good afternoon, everyone, and good morning for those of you in the West. I'm really pleased to be here and speak today. However, I did think I was going to have breaking news for you. There's a legislative package being tabled imminently and some important implications for supporting employees in the current circumstances. And I'm actually not at liberty to say anything about that until it comes through. So I'm watching my email for that to happen. I don't know if you want to have your other speaker speak first, or I can go over some of what's happened with EI since roughly March 11. But I'll just maybe ask you, Dennis, do you want to have your other speaker speak first, or?
If there's something imminent coming in the next few minutes, so you can is it okay, Laura? Are you prepared to jump in before we, and then come back to Judith?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, let's do that. Yeah. Thank you. And when you're done, Laura, we'll back over to Judith, and maybe she can give us some breaking news. Thank you.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. So I'm actually going to be speaking today about the employer's perspective of a layoff situation and some things to consider. So I should probably start by noting that a lot of my experience mainly relates to legislation in Ontario. So you'll want to be mindful of what your specific legislation says per province. They're fairly similar, but there are a few differences. So it's important for everyone to be mindful that when laying off an employee, it could be considered constructive dismissal. And that's mainly if a layoff has never been initiated previously in your workplace and the potential for a layoff is not outlined in an employment contract. So, for example, any sort of seasonal layoff. In these unprecedented times, though, the court will most likely side with employers as this is a temporary measure taken to prevent employment termination. So generally, employees have to agree to a temporary layoff, whether through a collective agreement or an employment contract. Obviously, these are unprecedented times, and the outcome should an employee take any sort of legal action is unknown at this time. But I really would doubt that the court would side with employees as long as everything's been done in good faith. It's encouraged that employers speak with their employees about a potential layoff and what that's going to look like. So you'll want to indicate that it is temporary in nature and how we'll be recalling people, how we're going to be laying people off. This should be done in writing also for documentation's sake. So you'll want to ensure that employees get a copy of that letter. So that letter should indicate that it's a temporary layoff and it will begin on such and such date. If you intend to have a recall date put in that letter, you can include it then. If not, you can say we will contact you by recall, and you'll have a certain amount of time generally to accept that recall. Usually within a collective agreement, you see anywhere from 3 to 5 days. So if you do have a collective agreement, the process around a layoff and recall is most likely outlined. If you don't, you will want to consider how you're going to create that process. So Will you be laying off by department, by skill and ability, by seniority, and how will you be recalling? This is really important to set out beforehand because you want to have consistency. So you don't want to lay off people without any sort of system in place, as it could add to your risk of constructive dismissal. So if you're saying we're going to be laying everybody off and then we'll recall everyone at the same time, that's obviously fairly easy. If you're going to be laying off maybe a certain department that's not as busy, or maybe you're going to keep people with the highest skill and ability, or maybe you're keeping people with the highest seniority. Just things to consider, because that consistency will show that you're not picking and choosing which employees are to go. You'll want to remind employees that they should update their contact information with the company if they need to. So if they've moved recently or changed their phone number, it's important that you have all that contact information so that you can recall them. And there is an option that's available for employers to top up employees while they're on a layoff. So if they're collecting EI, employers can top them up with a supplementary unemployment benefit. And this will increase the employee's weekly earnings and when they're unemployed due to temporary stoppage of work, illness, or quarantine. So this has to be registered with Service Canada and is not considered earnings and aren't deducted from the EI benefits. So more information on this can be found on the Service Canada website, but it is an option if employers are looking to assist employees throughout this difficult time. And also, in most cases, if a layoff exceeds 13 weeks, it's considered a termination of employment and all termination pay, severance, would be owed to those employees. In Ontario, a layoff can exceed more than 13 weeks if the employer continues to pay benefits. So that could be your benefit premiums, RSP contributions, anything like that. So you'll want to be mindful of your individual province and what surrounds what a layoff is, but also consider that it could be end up being a termination of employment should this exceed the 13 weeks. So that's essentially an overview of the layoff process. But it's important to keep employees up to date on what your plans are, how you're going to be recalling them, how you're going to lay them off. And as long as you have that communication open, you'll reduce your risk in the long run of any sort of constructive dismissal.
Okay, well, thank you. Are you finished, or is there more, Laura?
Nope, as long as I'm just sticking with the layoff process, that's pretty much a basic overview of what any employer would need to know.
Okay, thank you. Judith, if you're still with us,
I'm still here. I don't have the breaking news
about
it yet, but I'll talk about what's gone on recently, although not today. So there's been several measures announced since the outbreak around March, starting on March 11, there were announcements. First of all, the direction to self-isolate and quarantine, there was a regulation that passed that allows the mandatory 1 week waiting period to be waived from the first week of the claim. And so as your commissioner, I had to participate in approving that. On the sickness front, which is where quarantine falls, an employee can have up to 15 weeks of financial assistance and up to the usual maxima and so forth. In another effort to expedite, there was work done to improve the work sharing program so that the maximum of 38 weeks could in fact be extended to 76 weeks, and eliminating the cooling off period. If someone already had a work sharing agreement, there was no need to serve a cooling off before proceeding with an extension. I can tell you that more recently there's been much more work done to streamline the work sharing program, and I've participated in that. I think on the website it says 30 days. People thought that was a waiting period. It was actually a service standard, but there's been much effort to vastly trim that 30 days. And that information will be forthcoming shortly, so you could look up EI Work Sharing on the ESDC website and find the new rules. The department also has a website on COVID-19, and so there's information there around EI, occupational health and safety, and as I mentioned, work sharing. On March 18, there was an announcement of some additional benefits first of all, for people who do not qualify for employment insurance based on their weeks of work and contributions and so forth. So there's an emergency support benefit that will be coming available, as well as an emergency care benefit. And those are separate, and the link is on the Finance Department website under the Economic Response Plan for Canadians and businesses. I had occasion to work with another kind of interesting stakeholder group called the Canadian Payroll Association, and supported them in putting together a summary sheet on how to fill records of employment in these very unusual circumstances. And that's been very well received. I know that CME has shared that. So the challenge, of course, for the EI system is that to be honest, a very complex system and quite an old design. And so it wasn't really set up for the current circumstances that we're facing. One of the centerpieces of establishing a claim is the record of employment form, which is a complicated thing, as I'm sure you well know. Anyway, the bulletin from the Payroll Association gets into how to properly fill it so that the claims can proceed through the automated system as opposed to being tripped down into the manual system. And so there's quite a lot of tips in there. Like, don't put anything in the comment section that automatically trips to manual. There's no specific code for COVID. Basically sickness or quarantine, if it's a shortage of work, it's that code. So that is the information there. I would also like to mention subplans, which were covered just a moment ago. EI subplans allow firms to top up the EI benefit, including for the waiting period and to top up the 55%. And those are supposed to be registered with the EI system in advance. So there is work being done to also expedite those kinds of approvals and make sure that wherever an employer wants to improve the amount to the employee who's on layoff, or they're allowed to do that. So I will stop there. I'm very sorry I can't tell you about the major announcement that's coming shortly, but I will get that information directly to Dennis and Matt and have a debrief with them probably tomorrow, and so you will have the information very quickly.
Thank you, Judith, and thank you, Laura, and I know that we're going to turn it over to Rhonda now. Just to remind everybody that that Payroll Association document that Judith referred to, I believe it's on our website. And you can access it there. So anyway, Rhonda, assuming, over to you.
Okay, thank you, Dennis, and thank you, Judith and Laura, for your presentation. As you all know, I think last night, manufacturing in Ontario was deemed an essential service. I think across Canada, we're essential service. And yet, we are just as impacted in terms of absenteeism and fear within our employees as any industry, and this creates a unique set of circumstances for us. So a couple of questions or comments on that, like right at the top, Judith, I have people in my company that can't come to work because of daycare issues, or out of fear, or they have a cold and they don't know what it is, so they're away. And most people have already burned through their annual allotment of sick time that I, as a small company, can afford to pay. So what tools do we have now as this absenteeism continues with the EI system in terms of turning on and off a claim? Can an employee use a claim in a short period of time and go back on it if they were to get sick or we were shut down because of an outbreak or a closure? So that'd be sort of one question that I'm interested in. And then a question for Laura. I'm interested in employers' rights in sort of knowing what's going on behind the scenes in terms of employee health, or can we move to a point where we can mandate that we need to take temperatures before coming in the door, et cetera, to keep our workplaces safe? And in terms of employees' rights to refuse work over basically the fears, I have people in my own company that are afraid that some of their coworkers aren't adhering to the proper distancing outside of work, and these are fear-based, but do they have rights to refuse work? So those are kind of my two questions. Maybe Judith, you could start.
I'll start, although they are mostly legal questions. I can say that the advice that's in the Payroll Association bulletin in terms of employees who refuse to report to work due to risk of exposure, the recommendation from them is to use code N, leave of absence, on the record of employment, because it could be a quid, it could be other things, but that would occasion a legal battle, and it's not clear who would win it. And so that's the recommendation there. I think the employers are quite hampered in this circumstance in terms of what you can do to enforce attendance. And I would expect Laura has a view on what you can do to about taking temperatures and so forth. So I will end there and let Laura go after them.
Yeah, so the temperature thing, I know as far as and medical professionals and anyone working in a long-term care home, they have to go through a certain screening process in order to start work, and that does include getting your temperature taken and obviously answering various questions related to COVID-19. I have yet to hear a private business take any sort of temperatures. You'd want to be careful of some human rights there, as well as, although it's not an invasive procedure, generally the forehead scan, you would want to be mindful of, is it a bona fide a reason for the role? So essentially, if I'm a nurse going into a long-term care facility, it's important that I get screened because I'm dealing with, a vulnerable population. I don't know if the argument would be the same there. However, things are so rapidly changing with all sorts of procedures such as this that it would not surprise me if within the next week that becomes a regular practice and it's deemed absolutely fine. So I'd have to say I'm unsure on that, because if you had asked me a month ago, I would have probably said I would refrain from doing that. As far as employees refusing to work, we've been in close contact at BDO and our whole service line with a variety of employment lawyers, and there seems to be a very good argument to claim a refusal of work under the Occupational Health and Safety Act for people fearing any sort of repercussions from COVID-19, anyone that's not following the process and the protocols outlined by the government. So if someone does approach you and say, I would like to refuse work, they feel, and this is a group of employment lawyers, that they would have very good grounds under the Occupational Health and Safety Act to go home. I don't know, though, what that would look like, and maybe Judith could comment from a benefits perspective, because they technically aren't leaving for
take care of her children. They're not personally ill, and there is work available for them. So from my perspective, it's a bit of a gray area, but maybe Judith has more insight into that.
Well, again, the Payroll Association, I think, consulted lawyers too, and the code in leave of absence was recommended just to avoid the fight about it. I mean, obviously, yeah, employers can do a lot to improve distances between workers and that kind of thing, if that's possible. But ultimately, it's taking Laura's point that things are changing rapidly. I think the best advice is to mark code N on the ROE leave of absence, understanding that could lead to a whole lot of attrition of people badly needed.
Thank you for your comments. Matt, did you have further questions that you wanted to bring up, or did you want me to continue?
Keep going if you have some more, Rhonda. I think that we're on to something here.
Okay. I don't know if we fully dug into my comment, Judith, around turning benefits on and off. So if I put an employee out on sick leave and they come back in, say, 2 to 4 weeks, and then 2 or 3 weeks later they need to go back on, are there mechanisms for that to be reenacted, or do you foresee complications of turning benefits on and off?
Well, I did mention that the EI system is pretty turgid. And for one thing, it takes quite a while to set up a claim in the first place. Even in normal times, the setting up of a claim takes on average 28 days. So, and then there's the 1 week waiting period. So that's part of the 28. But when the individual finally is put in to pay, they get, more in their initial payment because it's already been 28 days. And that's in normal times with the kind of volumes the systems has been receiving. And the potential for many of these claims to trip to manual, it's not a quick process, which is kind of why I was hoping that we would have the announcement that's coming. So the turning on and off on a quick basis simply doesn't happen in normal times, and it certainly wouldn't happen in these sorts of times. And I think when a claim is established, a person can use so many weeks of their sick entitlement if they've only used a few and they still have some left. They could potentially go back. But the question that's been asked of me is whether an employer can require a sick certificate of wellness in order to come back. Now, that's not something that the EI system deals with. The EI system, of course, deals with medical notes for sickness, and those have actually been waived for the moment because it was just too much of a load on the healthcare system. So the notion of getting a note of approval to return to work and then fall sick again is probably not a scenario that could easily happen. And probably Laura has some more insights on that one.
Yeah, well, in normal times, I would say get a note for them to return. But I think it's on the same point as why they shouldn't be getting a note to go off. It's the burden on the healthcare system. If you had an employee that tested positive, I think that's a much different approach. But your health unit would be involved in that process already and making the determination when they're fit to return to work. But I think it would be very difficult to ask employees to get a return to work note just under the circumstances. Getting into your family doctor is near impossible, and obviously most clinics, at least in my area, have been shut down, and obviously hospitals have tight restrictions. So I think in this moment that would be a tough ask, But I think it's a concern of how do you ensure that people returning are in fact fit to return. But unfortunately, I don't think there's a clear answer on that yet either.
Great. Thank you. Maybe I'll jump in now, Rhonda, with a few questions that I've been receiving. I've tried to group them as best I can into the broad theme, so I'll just throw them out there, and either Judith or Laura, you can jump on it if you want. So a lot of questions on the waiting period for EI benefits versus sickness benefits. And the question around, is the 1 week waiting period being waived for regular EI benefits?
No, it had not been waived.
The
theory on the sickness benefits was to make sure that people made the right decision to follow an order of quarantine or self-quarantine, or if necessary, because no one wants someone who's, been exposed or potentially could infect others to be at work because they need the pay. And so that's the theory upon which the 1 week waiting period for quarantine was / sickness was waived, but for shortage of work, it is not waived.
Great. Another question, I think it comes more down to the strategy from a business standpoint of, a lot of questions I've been getting are people, they're debating between whether to lay off and use let the EI system catch their workers, to use work share, investigate the work share option, although I've had a lot of comments that they didn't end up taking it because it's taking too long, or to involve the process and they need to know these things now. Maybe Laura, on that front, as a business who's weighing these options that they have in front of them, right? Is there any sort of guidance that you can give to members and to companies on how they should approach making those types of decisions? They're obviously not easy, and they're very complicated, and everyone's going to be different, but is there any sort of general best practices when it comes to that?
Well, it's generally very unique to whatever your business needs are, but there are options. So if you're looking at lack of work, is it laying off, a set number of people and working with a skeleton crew? There's options to do what we call kind of a cyclical layoff. So maybe you're bringing people in for 2 weeks, laying them off, and then another crew comes in. That allows them to get EI benefits as well as know that they're getting a guaranteed full income for that 2 weeks. It also keeps employees engaged in their employment. So if I know that, I'm going to be laid off for 2 weeks, but I'm also scheduled in 2 weeks and I'm going to be guaranteed 2 weeks of employment for that time, I'm probably not going out and looking elsewhere. Not that many places are hiring right now, but it keeps them engaged. And I think it's an option that makes people at least feel like the employer is doing everything possible to keep employees not only financially secure, but also within their role. And then obviously there is the work share application, and Judith would probably have more information on that, but I've done work share applications plenty in the past, and it's an extensive process, generally a bit more long-term than a layoff. So you're looking 6 months, 9 months down the road, are we still going to be in this situation? And no one can really answer that question right now. But it's really a tough call, and sometimes you want to react immediately because obviously there's a downturn in business immediately, but you want to also keep in mind where do we think we're going to be a month from now, 2 months from now, 3 months from now, and where do we want to be, and what's in our control.
Right.
And I would just add on this that from a strategy standpoint, I've mentioned how long it takes for EI regular benefits to be processed and put into pay. And at the same time, the work sharing option, the extensive application that Laura talked about has been drastically improved. And so it could be more immediate. In fact, I think probably would be more immediate. And as Laura mentioned, keeps people engaged, keeps everyone involved, and is really a good way to keep body and soul together for all concerned in order to get through this. With the extensions to work sharing and so forth, there really should be no reason even, you know, for companies not to either, you know, renew their work sharing agreement. If they've had one before, they know what's involved and it's now a lot easier. Or else set a new one up. The application process was pretty extensive because there had to be a plan, a recovery plan made up by the employer. Well, in this kind of circumstance, pretty much everyone will say the recovery plan is to, you know, for the public health emergency to be handled and dealt with, and everything can come back after that. So there's no need for, detailed recovery plans employer by employer in this circumstance. So there's been a lot of different ways that the application can be truncated and get the program going faster than certainly it would take for a benefit to come through.
That's great. Thank you, Judith. Dennis, that sort of sums up a lot of the questions.
Okay.
I had some more, but they actually, our speakers were so good they covered them in their remarks. So,
that's true. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our three. In fact, that was extremely informative. And I know, as usual, we're recording these, so they'll post it on the webpage, our COVID-19 resource page, just so you can listen to them again or share them at work. Our next call is on Thursday at 1:10. On Thursday, we'll be talking about how to run manufacturing facilities during COVID-19, how to create compliant workspaces, to respect social distancing. It's been given the green light to continue its operations, but we have to do it in a way that eases worker angst and about safety and healthy workspaces. So it's not an easy subject. We know that manufacturers are facing a lot of stresses, and we're hopeful that some of those announcements that Judith hinted at will provide some relief to you and to your employees. If you have any concerns on anything related to this or other topics, you can reach out to CME at any time. We're here to help you. That's why we exist. Let me thank our speakers. Let me thank our moderator, Rhonda, and let me thank all of you. We hope you stay well, and we will see you on Thursday. Good afternoon.